You're listening to a resource from the Association of Certified Biblical Counselors, where we seek to promote excellence in biblical counseling. For more resources or to find out more information about ACBC, please visit us at biblicalcounseling.com.
Today, during this hour, my responsibility is to work through the material that you have in front of you. Do you all have the stuff from your app or something? If you want to find that material, we're going to talk about developing a culture of discipleship as a necessary precursor to a local church biblical counseling ministry. Let me just give you a little brief background. My name is Wayne Vanderweer. God's given me the privilege of serving him for the last 13 and a half years as the founding director of an international biblical counseling training ministry called Overseas Instruction in Counseling. That was up until yesterday. Yesterday, I lost my job. Yesterday, we inaugurated a new executive director for OIC, and I was moved over to the position of director at large, not large director. I'm probably that also, but I'm very grateful to God for a wonderful, about 3.5 year, actually 1 year, very intense transition period that has moved us from my leadership to the leadership of the next guy who will do it much better than I will do it in the out years, Dr. Andrew Rogers, who's a member of the board of directors of ACBC, a fellow, a certified training center director, and a dear friend for a lot of years. We're very grateful to God that we've been able to have this change and have him take over this ministry at this point. Let me just give you a brief introduction to the ministry of OIC, and then we're going to jump into the material that you have before you. It's important that you know that there's an organization like OIC, an organization that gives itself to training biblical counseling trainers around the world. We're doing what many of you are doing in your local churches, except we're doing it in about 30 nations all over the world, through a team of, so far, 21 missionary families. But this week is also our missionary training conference. So our missionary training conference straddles the ACBC meeting. That means that we met all day Monday over at the seminary building across the street. We had about 50 folks, our current missionary team, and then we're welcoming this week 11 new missionary families. So we'll have 32, Lord willing, by the end of the week, 32 missionary families that we deploy all over the world to do biblical counseling training with pastors and in graduate programs. We're very grateful to God for what he's doing as we're training biblical counseling trainers. These are the locations in the places around the world where OIC is serving. We're thankful to God for a wonderful team. I'm going to have to change this to the presenter view so I can see what's going on here. A wonderful team of folks serving in all of these nations this year, the ones that are emboldened are the places where Susie and I, my sweet wife and I, have traveled this year. So we stay on the road about 150,000 air miles a year. Something like 100 flights a year to various nations, meeting with foreign national leaders and establishing biblical counseling programs in churches and theological schools all over the world. This is our team of 21 missionary families at this point. This array will grow significantly after this week, and we're just going to have to use smaller pictures or make more panels. I'm not sure which, but we're very grateful to God for wonderful folks who are involved in the ministry of OIC. Many of these are guys with earned doctorates. Several are fellows of this organization, and some actually run certified training centers of their own in other places. As I mentioned, this week is our missionary training conference, and over at the seminary, they've given us an amazing, they've just been really wonderful to us. I've heard several people here say how good Bellevue has been to ACBC as a host. The same is true of the Mid-American Baptist Theological Seminary across the street in hosting us in our missionary training conference this week. We will pick it up on Thursday at 1 o'clock, go the rest of the day Thursday, all day Friday. And so we're going to be busy beavers this week, not just the missionary training conference, the ACBC conference, also the ACBC leadership meeting Wednesday evening and Thursday morning. What a week, right? This is the no-sleep week, and this is the try-to-stay-awake week, especially when you're teaching week. So I'm very grateful to God for all that he is doing. All right, let me jump into the material here. If you have additional questions, by the way, we're downstairs. among the exhibits there, number 17, next to the staircase. And you can stop in. We have coasters for you, luggage tags for you. The first 200 people, I don't know where we are in that, but the first 200 people that get there get a T-shirt. And can imagine that, a free OIC T-shirt. Can you imagine? I mean, that's what you've always wanted, right? That and a buck and a half will get you a coffee at McDonald's. So, if you'd like a free T-shirt, come on down and see us. Other things are there. And information, of course, about our ministry, more than I can give you in a quick prelim to the seminar here. All right, let me explain the lay of the land here. Where are we? In our church leadership training program, this is one of the things that we do, church leadership training for pastors in nations through a modular program. We also cooperate with theological schools, and with those theological schools, we produce master's degrees, so MABCs in six different locations around the world. The theological school takes care of the Bible and theology portion of the curriculum. We take care of the biblical counseling portion of the curriculum, and we actually have MABC programs going in various places. Most of what we do is the church leadership training. About 80% in most of the nations, we have church leadership training programs. And those church leadership programs are four modules. They take place typically about every 6 months. The way we say it is, congratulations, pastor. By the way, these are for pastors and those they bring with them. This is not a y'all come. This is pastors and those they bring with them. So congratulations, you're here. This is module one. Guess what happens at the end of module one? You get projects for growth. Projects for growth, do you know what that is? Somebody, what's it called? We never use the H word. In the little world of OIC, we have banned the H word because it's just a personal thing. I think it's punitive, perhaps even pejorative, so I don't like the H word. I say to folks, I'm on a one-man crusade to eliminate the word homework from biblical counseling nomenclature. It's a crusade I am destined to lose. Because that word is embedded in the ethos since Competent to Counsel in 1970. So I know I'm going to lose this, but I'm going to fight on regardless. But thank you very much. And we use the term projects for growth. Who likes that? You like that? It's hope-producing, isn't it, just when you say that? So we, isn't that right? So instead of homework, who wants to do home? Anyway, so I'm selling here. So module one, we do that, then we give them projects for growth. And here's what we say, Pastor, if you do the projects for growth, you can come back for module two. And if you don't, you can't. Because this is not a seminar or a series of seminars. This is a training program. And to be trained to do something, you have to read in that field and write and study the Bible about that field and actually practice the thing that you are being trained to do, whatever that thing is. This is a training program. So we give them projects for growth, and here's the way our curriculum runs. The first module, just talking about biblical counseling, basics, what it is, a definition. We talk about the dynamics of biblical change in that module. Module two, we have our own proprietary seven key element process model, and we talk about the procedures of biblical counseling. In the third module, it's basically common issues addressed in biblical counseling. And then in the fourth module, we talk about the local church. Why? Because we are, as an organization, relentlessly local church focused. Why? Because I was, before I worked with OIC, I was a local church pastor for 32 years. And I know what you're thinking when I say that. You don't look old enough to be, wasn't that what you were thinking? Please? Apparently not. Okay, I really am old enough. And my heart is in pastoring for pastors. This is what I love. And I'm so grateful to God for all of those years that he allowed me the privilege of being a pastor. And it became very clear to me that what we need to do in ministering around the world is to help pastors. That's literally what brought about this ministry in the first place. I went to the first place, that I was ever asked to go do a biblical counseling course at a little Bible institute in Hungary. And when I got off the plane, I said to the director, "So here's the question. Not can I teach 18, 19-year-old kids basic elements of biblical counseling? That's pretty simple. They don't know enough to ask good questions or to push back in any way. The question is, who's helping the pastors in Hungary?" You know what the answer is? Nobody. And then God allowed me to go to other places as well, even during my pastoral years. And I kept asking that same question. Who's helping the pastors? I was a pastor. I have a heart for pastors. I want to help pastors. And I know that when I went to seminary in a good conservative evangelical seminary in America in the 70s, yes, they had seminaries back in the 70s, when I went to a really good school, conservative school, I got nothing. And I thought, if I didn't get any help in personal ministry, if soul care was never addressed in my seminary training, in my good school in America, what hope is there that in less developed nations or nations whose theological training isn't as robust, what hope is there that there's going to be help for pastors in those nations? The answer is, there's no hope at all, and they're not getting help. So by God's grace, we launched OIC in 2006, and this then became the heartbeat for Module 4, how to do it, how to share it, how you can develop in your church a biblical counseling and training center. So that module, Module 4, has three parts. And Part 1 is all preparation stuff. It's getting the church ready to do this kind of thing. I'll just answer one of your questions now. One of the questions you'll ask at the end is, how long does it take to shift the corporate culture of a church to be dedicated to soul care, dedicated to developing a soul care team? And the answer is, I don't know. The answer is, it's different for every church that seeks to make this kind of shift. There are churches that are born on this footing, and this is already in their DNA. Great. Easy peasy for you. There are other churches and pastors who go to churches like I did in 1981 that are very traditional, very stuck on doing the things that they've always done in the way they've always done them. How long does it take to shift the corporate culture? It takes a while, because you need to be patient about that. So we're going to work on the preliminary stuff in Part 1 of our Module 4. And this lecture, this session, actually comes right out of that first section, developing a culture of discipleship in your church. What does that look like? How does that work in order to have the ability to be able to move forward with doing good soul care? You see in the abstract or in the introduction to the notes, this phrase, caring for souls, happens in a church environment in which making disciples is systemic to the culture. It is just what the church lives and breathes. It is the language the church uses. It has become what we call here, for the sake of this session, the corporate culture of that church. But how do you create that culture? Now I'm looking around and I'm seeing some dear friends who are in churches already where that culture exists. Thank God for that. That's hard fought and difficult to earn in some places. So what we're going to do in this session is talk about that. We start with this kind of introductory questions. How many churches have you visited recently? When I was a pastor for 32 years, I didn't visit very many churches because turns out that, you know, my church wanted me to be, you know, at church. Preaching and doing stuff pastors do. So we didn't visit very many churches. Then God's providence, in 2006, he allowed us to begin OIC, which means a couple of different things. First, we're a missionary organization, so we need to connect with like-minded churches, what we call biblical-friendly churches, or even biblical counseling friendly, or even biblical counseling immersed churches, because those are the kinds of churches that we think will support an international biblical counseling ministry. So we, and by the way, Faith Church in Lafayette and Brad Bigney's church in Florence, Kentucky, and the church out in North Creek, California is going to support us. We have lots of the major churches in the biblical counseling movement that are supporting OIC as a missionary organization. and your church could too. That's another promotion that I just throw that in there. We started, Susie and I, traveling to churches to pitch the idea of an international biblical counseling. That meant that we were going to be going around to a different church every week. And we also started to travel. And as we started to travel to different nations all around the world, we would go to, and very often I would preach in, churches in other cultures. So not only in America, but also around the world, Susie and I started being in a different church almost every week of the year. We are church members, by the way, today. We have a wonderful pastor. Our pastor and his wife are among our dearest friends on earth. We love our pastor and his wife. But we're in our own church about three times a year these days. My pastor is the guy who says, Wayne, we always like it when you're not here, because it means that you're busy doing what we are supporting you to do someplace either around the country or around the world. So can you imagine a pastor being happy when members don't show up? My pastor is. And so we started traveling around. Here's what we discovered. What we discovered is that churches are like people. Every one of them has their own personality. It's a pretty remarkable thing when you start going around and seeing, starting to test and quantify what we're calling here in this session, the corporate culture, the way a church thinks and moves and reacts and responds. It's really interesting to begin to attempt to quantify some of those things, not only in American churches, but also around the world. Brad Brandt, you all know Brad Brandt? Say yes or no. If you don't, you should. Brad's one of our fellows. He's the CTC director, pastor of a church in Wheelersburg, Ohio. He does CDTs in places. One of the places he and his church serve is an area in West Virginia. So he called me this several years ago, Wayne, would you come and teach in our CDT? And so I was available to be able to do that. So by God's grace, we went down there, went over to West Virginia, and here's this. It's the most amazing. Now, this is a pretty amazing facility. Down there in this very remote place, here's this church. I couldn't believe it when we came up on it. We drove into the parking lot of this place, and I looked at it. It looks, ladies and gentlemen, for all the world like a hunting lodge. You know what I'm talking about? Huge stone fireplace, big. I mean, it's a hunting lodge. And I thought, is this the church? Now, why, when they built their new facility, did they build it to look like that? Because in that area of West Virginia, everybody hunts. And they hunt all the time, and they hunt anything that moves. And they love hunting. So when it's time to build a new church building, what do? You build a hunting lodge-looking church building. I thought, that is a very interesting illustration of how the personality, or what's important to a church, the church's culture, is reflected even in its architecture. Interesting idea. And so you'll discover this too as you go around. And so let's just talk about this concept that I'm calling here corporate culture. Now, that might be just a little bit weird to say the word corporate, because you think about business. I'm using corporate in the broader sense of just being collective, a thing that we're talking about in a unity. What's the corporate culture? How do we think about what that is? How do we define it? So here are just a few, five bullet points. I think the first one or the second one or something you have to write down. Here's the first one. Corporate culture is a blend of the values, beliefs, taboos, symbols, rituals, and myths that all organizations develop over time. A blend of all of those kinds of things. And your church has a personality. That is to say, your church has a corporate culture. And it is a blend of all of these kinds of things. Let's be a little bit more specific. Some of these you have in your notes. The term describes and governs the way an organization's leaders and employees slash members, and I'm using that term carefully here to say in the corporate sense it's employees, in the church sense it's members. The term describes and governs the way the organization's leaders and members, in this case for the church, think, feel, and act. Have you ever walked into a church as a visitor when you're on vacation? You walk into the lobby, and in some places, before you get to the lobby, there's a guy opening the door, right? and he's welcoming you, and he's handing you a church bulletin or a paper or something, and you walk into the lobby, and there's people by the door to greet you and to direct you, and if you have children, they tell you right. You have that experience? Say yes or no. Yeah. Do you ever walk into a church where you're ignored? You are a first-time guest. You don't know nothing about nothing, like where to park or where to go or what do I do next or even where's the sanctuary. You walk in, and you are just, and you see, here's a group of friends over here, and here's a group of friends over here, and they're all having a great time talking about whatever it is they're talking about, and you kind of, right? I'm lost. I don't know, right? That's a part of the ethos. That's a part of the culture of that church, that they're not alert to the guests that walk in, people who are unknown to them. Third, corporate culture includes the way the organization conducts its business or its ministry. Some have attempted to shift the way ministry is done, especially as churches grow. Do you know you can't do in a church of 2,000 what you do in a church of 50? Did you know that? Systems have to change. Decision-making needs to change. Leadership structures need to change. Change? Did I just say the word change three times? We got any Baptists here? Are you apoplectic at my using the word change? Right? You know the old joke? How many biblical counselors does it take to change a light bulb? Do you know the answer? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to be changed. That's true. So how does your church deal with business, the business of the church and the ministry of the church? Corporate culture then also includes the way the organization treats its, in the corporate sense, employees, customers, or in this case, the members of the church, and the way the church treats the wider community. So, and it may not be the same for members and the wider community. In some cases, the church treats the members really well. There's a good soul care mentality, but they ignore the community. In some cases, it's all about the community, only the community counts. And then the members shrivel up, and they get bitter, and there's rumors and gossip and stuff flying around, but we're all focused on the community. You understand how that goes, right? You've seen all this stuff as well. Corporate culture also includes the way the organization allows or even encourages freedom in decision-making within assigned roles. So, for example, you're new to the church, you've been there now for a couple of years, and somebody comes to you and says, hey, you know what we'd like you to do? We'd like you to take over the junior high program and work with the junior high kids. And you say, great, what do I do first? Now, the answer that comes tells you about the corporate culture. Because in some places, and I'm not giving a value judgment on either one of these ends of the spectrum, but in some places, what's going to happen is they're going to say, this is our curriculum, this is what we use, this is when we meet, this is how long we meet, this is what you're supposed to do, follow this curriculum, make disciples out of junior hires using this stuff. And you would say, great. I mean, on one hand, you'd say, thank you, I don't have to reinvent the wheel. Thank you for giving me tracks to run on. I've got some idea of what needs to be done. In other cases, the church is going to say, well, I don't know, you're the junior high leader, figure it out. Okay, when do we meet? How often do we meet? What time of the day? What day of the week? What's the curriculum? What are we teaching? What are we aiming at? How do we know when the product has been successful? What are we pushing out the other end of the discipleship pipeline? What should a mature biblical junior hire look like at the end of eighth grade or ninth grade or middle school or whatever it is? How this speaks about the corporate culture. What does the church do about those kinds of things? How does it handle it? And there's a spectrum, as I just said. Corporate culture also includes the way the organization allows or even encourages creativity in developing new ideas or programs. So now you're in a particular church, and now you're busy doing the work that you're doing, and you're looking around at the church, and you're thinking, wow, you know what? You know what we need? What we really need is for someone to be. And so it may be a good idea. Maybe it's a bad idea. I don't know. But here's the question. Where do you take the idea? Who do you talk to about the idea? What's the leadership structure? What's the change structure? Where would you go with that idea? And what could you reasonably expect to hear as the result of what you share? In some places, the result of what you share, let's say that your idea seems to be reasonable and rational, in some places, the result is going to be, nope, can't do it. We've never done it that way before. That's just not us. That's not what our kind of church does. That doesn't hit us right. In other places, it's going to be, thanks, let's take that to the leadership bunch. Let's look that over. Let's think it through. Let's make some adjustments. Let's tweak that a little bit. This may really be helpful for us. The way that new ideas or projects are responded to talks a little bit about the corporate culture. And then corporate culture also includes the way the organization structures its leadership. How is the leadership? Did you ever try to change a church leadership structure? You don't have to confess. I did. I was so young and foolish. Do you know, any of you guys ever start pastoring when you were so young you didn't even know what you didn't know? That was me. I just was naive. And I walked into a church, and I went there eyes wide open. I had read the documents, the constitution, the bylaws, and so on. But after being there for a little while, you could recognize why there was the turmoil in the church that there was. And so I took this to the leadership bunch, and I said, it seems to me that one of the issues might be that we're actually violating Scripture in the way that we think about the leadership structure of the church. Right? I might as well have denied the virgin birth or the blood atonement. Change, are you kidding me? Change the Constitution? You know who wrote the Constitution, don't you? The founders of our, are you saying we've been doing it wrong all these, are you saying you know better than all of the generations of leaders? You get it, right? Have you been there? Say yes or no. Yeah, I'm afraid so. It's not. So how do we structure the leadership, and then how do we structure information flow from the leadership? And in some churches, of course, you know, that's done really well, consistently, openly, transparently. And in some places, you have no idea what the elders are thinking or doing, and they don't want you to know. It'll be a surprise when they announce it to you next Sunday, whatever it is that they have in mind. So all of those things speak to the concept of corporate culture, the way that the church is functioning, and all of those things need to be evaluated. Now, please notice this. I think it's in your notes. The only way to really understand a culture is to be immersed in it. So that some of you have spent time overseas. Some of you have maybe overseas missionaries. Maybe you've lived in other cultures. If you're an American who has lived in another culture, here's what's true. You could go to that culture, you could learn that language, and you could live in that culture for 20 or 30 years. You are still not a member of that culture, right? You're still a transplant. You're still an expat. And you can speak the language like a native, and you can love them well, and you can serve them well, and you can do great work, and I trust that you have. But the fact is, you're still an expat. So you can be immersed in that, and even in a church, think about this. How do you come to know the corporate culture of a church? You go to the new member classes, right? Well, what are the new member classes? They are a commercial, aren't they? Why? Because the church wants you to become a member. So what are they? This is dating, ladies and gentlemen. That's what this is. Dating. It's putting the best foot forward. It's always being on your best, always looking your best. So the church's new member classes do that. They're dating you, and they hope that you'll make a commitment. And then if you do that after 2 months or 3 months or 5 months, and now you become a member of the church, now all of a sudden, that you are a member and you begin serving in some of the ministries, now all this corporate culture stuff that I've been describing starts to be revealed. Now you start to understand how things really are around here, and it may be a little bit different than what you were told. Corporate culture can be formal. By formal, I mean It can be given by specific statements. And here are some of those kinds of statements. You have to write the questions in, I guess. Here are the questions that you want to ask and answer in order to identify in a formal way the corporate culture of your church. First, why do you exist? The question, why do you exist, is answered by a vision statement. It is probably going to begin with the words, to glorify God by something. But that's why we all exist, right? Say yes or no. Why did God make you? For his glory. Why did God redeem you? For his glory. Why did Jesus do everything that he did on earth? For God's glory. You know that, right? So it's probably going to start like that. This is the vision statement for the church that describes why you exist. What is your goal? The goal is, how will you know when you've reached the objective? What is the goal? I liken it sometimes to an auto manufacturing plant. You know what you've got? Big building here, and what you have in this end is raw materials coming in or pre-assembled parts coming in. You've got some stuff coming in this end of the building. And what happens during the process is the car starts being put together. They put the engine in the engine mount. They put the fenders on. They put the doors on. They put, right? And then by the time it gets over here and you drive it out, you've got a car, a fully assembled, usable car. If the mission of the church is to make disciples, and it is, I have that on good authority. Anybody ever hear Jesus say that? Say yes or no. Matthew 28, 19. You got that, right? What did Jesus say? Make disciples. In your going, make disciples. Where? In all nations. That's our part. Make disciples. What's the mission of the church? Make disciples. Let's see that as an assembly line. And coming in this end over here are either people that you're leading to faith in Christ, brand new believers, or some pre-assembled believers. You know what I mean? People who have already been believers, they've moved to your area, and they may be, by the way, assembled correctly, or they may be assembled incorrectly. Did you know that? That happens, right? Katie's husband, long before he was her husband, came to me, and he said, they're in the restaurant consulting business. He's a restaurateur and manager of a restaurant when she met him, and he's a restaurant aficionado, right? And he came to me to talk about Katie. He said, do you know what I like to do? My favorite part of being the leader, the manager of a restaurant, you know what my favorite part is? Training servers. But here's the problem. If a person has been a server someplace else already, I have to untrain them before I can retrain them. I'd rather have a person who's never been a server before so I can train them from the beginning how to do a good job being a server. Does that make sense to you? And then he said to me, do you have anything like that in Christianity? And I said, yeah, we have something like that. And he said, would you do that with me? Right? And a year later, he got the girl. So, but that's, right? This is the assembly process. So what is the objective? What do you want to have coming out the other end of the pipeline, fully formed, fully devoted, relational, biblical, people with good theology who love people, who love Jesus, who can help people? That's what you want coming out the other end of the pipeline, all right? That's your objective. The question, how will you achieve it, is described by your mission statement. A little while ago, I put up the mission statement here for OIC. How will you achieve your strategic objective? And then, what do you value in the accomplishing of that objective? I would just say that if you want to think about shifting the corporate culture of the church, then these kinds of things, this is, in some places, this kind of thing is met with appreciation, and in some places, not. In some places, this kind of, oh, it's just academic gobbledygook. You expect us to sit down with the pastors or elders or deacons of our church and go on a retreat and spend time hammering out answers? Yes, I do. If you're interested in shifting the focus of the church from what it has been to what you believe it should be, the only way to get that done is to take the time to hammer this stuff out and then talk to the church about what you've hammered out and talk about the fact that our church is going to be an intentional disciple-making center. This is what we're going to do. There's 1,000 other good things to do. Did you know that? But some of those things can be done by the Red Cross or the Boy Scouts or UNICEF or somebody else. There's 1,000 good things to do. Here's what Jesus gave the church to do: make disciples. Somebody say amen. That's a very important thing. And you can easily get distracted doing a lot of other really good things and not make disciples. So how do you test whether or not you're an intentional disciple-making church? You have to answer some questions about what are we producing? Those that we consider to be the most mature people of our church, or here's another metric. What are our high school graduates valuing? What direction are they going? What do they want to do with their lives to bring glory to God? That's an interesting idea, isn't it? How many people have we ordained to the ministry? How many missionaries have we sent from our church? There's all kinds of metrics that you can use about this. So let me just I'll just fly through this because you don't really care about this. But these are examples. The vision statement for OIC is to glorify God through the spiritual strengthening of believers and churches around the world. Our strategic objective, as I mentioned, is to assist in the initial creation and or continuing development of national, culture-specific, biblical counseling, certifying organizations. So how do we know when we've got to the other end of the pipeline? It is that there is a standalone, by nationals, for nationals, culture-specific certification protocol being enacted in that nation. Not ACBC. By the way, I love ACBC. Is this being recorded? I love ACBC, just for the record. I'm a fellow and a CTC director. I have drunk the Kool-Aid, okay? I'm all in on ACBC. Did you hear that? Please say amen for the sake of the recording. Thank you very much. But I think it would be wrong missiologically to copy-paste what ACBC is doing and try to force it to fit into another culture. How are we going to require 1,000 pages of reading in another culture when there's literally no biblical counseling textbooks in that language? You can't do that. What do you do with nations where illiteracy is a serious problem? What do you do in places where travel is very, very difficult within a country of 10,000 islands like Indonesia or 7,200 islands like the Philippines? How do you address those things? What you don't do is attempt to impose the American standard on them. What you attempt to do is to help them train enough people in enough locations that you can bring together the thought leaders who will establish a national culture-specific biblical counseling certifying organization. Does that make sense to you? That's our strategic objective, and by God's grace, we have done and are doing that in many nations around the world. What's our mission statement then? You saw it before, training biblical counseling trainers, 2 Timothy 2:2. You all know that, right? Every mission organization uses that. The things that you've heard of me among many witnesses, the same commitment to faithful men, right? It's Paul and Timothy and faithful men and others. There's literally 4 generations of disciples. So what we are not doing is we are not training people to do biblical counseling. That's not the goal. The goal is to train those who will train others to do biblical counseling in the nations. We begin with that, and we begin in Module 1 saying to the pastors, it will be expected of you that you will develop a soul care team in your church, that you will train biblical counselors in your church, and that perhaps you will even train other pastors in your region in biblical sufficiency-based soul care, because we are training you to train others. Does that make sense? That's sort of the biblical model, isn't it? And then what's our values? This is the academic stuff. The values involve biblical priorities in our relationships, like humility and love and orderliness and excellence in our work, which includes diligence and dependability and enthusiasm. We have the 11th commandment in the little world of OIC. The 11th commandment is, thou shalt not be boring. We don't allow guys to stand at a lectern and read a manuscript. We want to engage with folks and demonstrate enthusiasm for the thing that we're doing. And here's the note. There could be a significant disparity between what's written in the organization and what's experienced. So here's what you do. You move to a new town, and you're looking up for a new church, and here's a church that's the tagline is, the friendliest church in town, which, by the way, is a terrible tagline for any church. But there it is, right in print. We're the friendliest church in town, right? So then you go there, and they ignore you. You can say it in print, any one of the four statements. You can say it and not do it, right? So better to underpromise and overperform. So corporate culture is always, it can be formal, the four statements, but it is always informal. What is spoken about, how it's spoken about, and or what's merely understood, this is when you get into the church, when you get into the organization, and then you really begin to understand how the corporate culture in this organization works. We talk about this even in our training with our pastor, with our missionaries, some of which are sitting here. Our missionary team members, both those that are already part of us and those that are becoming part of us this week, we want to make sure that what we say about OIC in our statements is actually what we do in the world of OIC. Where do we see this corporate cult concept in the Bible? There in the Old Testament, of course, there's 12 tribes, one nation. Now, let me ask you a question. Is the tribe of Levi and the tribe of Manasseh any different? Say yes or no. It couldn't be more different, right? One nation, many tribes. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. One God over all 12 tribes. But the tribes, in the way that they conducted themselves, were very different. In the New Testament, it's very easy to see. Any difference between Paul's letter, let's say, to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, and his letter to the Galatians? Say yes or no. You foolish Galatians. Why, right? I mean, now there's rebuke also in 1 Corinthians, but the tone is completely different in those two. Churches, all churches, churches that would probably have the same doctrinal statement because they were all started by the same apostle. Churches all over the place, one body and varying cultures. Now, here's the big question. Can organizations or churches with similar or identical purposes have disparate cultures? Say yes or no. Yes, of course, because everybody in this room believes what the Bible says is the mission of the church. The mission of the church is to make disciples, right? But some of you are in this place, and some of you are in that place, and some of you are in places far away. The way that the church functions, the corporate culture of the church, is going to be different in some ways, but the mission is going to be the same as everybody in the room. We're all here making disciples, right? My friend Thiago, where are you right now, Thiago? Thiago's been walking around the room. There he is, taking pictures for me. Thiago is our missionary in southern Brazil, the farthest most southern state in Brazil. He's a wonderful guy, and we've been down there a couple of times with he and his wife, and conducted some training down there in the far reaches of Brazil, right near Uruguay. And what a wonderful guy. Now, guess what? He's the pastor of a church. The way that his church conducts itself, the things that they do, the way that they do it is going to be Brazilian, right? And the way that we do it in my church is going to be American. But the mission is the same. The goal for both of us is to make disciples, because that's what Jesus said we're supposed to do. All right, here's the heart of it. How do you change it? Five steps. You have them there in your notes. Are you ready? First, the leaders need to recognize that the old ways are not producing disciples of Jesus Christ. Somebody has to have the courage to ask the question, is what we are now doing in this church producing fully committed, well-taught, disciples of Jesus who have a heart for God and for others. Is that happening? Do we see a growing cadre of mature, elder-ready men that we are intentionally producing through training? Do we see that or not? And if the answer is no, no kids are going to Bible college, no new missionaries are being sent, no pastors are being ordained from the church. If that's true, then we have to have the courage to look that straight in the face and say, okay, then whatever we're doing today, all the activities of the church, and there are many activities, are not all focused in the same way to make disciples. By the way, that is the question that needs to be asked in every local church about every single thing you do. How does this ministry contribute to the goal, which is making disciples? Please evaluate all of your ministries on that basis. Our pastor was gone on vacation, and we live in the parsonage right behind the church. And on a Thursday night, cars started pouring in, filling up the parking lot, and I had no idea what was going on. I was only concerned because one car drove right across our lawn as if it was part of the parking lot, which it is not, as it turns out. And so I called one of the other leaders, and I said, what's going on at church? He said, I don't know. I called another leader. He said, I don't know, but I'm going to go over there and find out. So he went over there and found out. What he found out, he called me later. He said, you know what it is? One of the members, one of the ladies, is part of a quilting club, and she wanted to use the church for the quilting club. Now, I have nothing against quilting, just to be clear, all right? Quilting does not show up in the Great Commission. Making disciples shows up. So is it okay to use the church facility for a quilting club? Sure, but it's not the mission of the church to host quilting clubs. It's the mission of the church to make disciples. So how is that quilting club being used to point ladies from the community who care about quilting, either to faith in Christ or to be better disciples of Jesus? Somebody needs to answer the question, how do we do discipleship through quilting? I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying we need to ask the question, right? It was, and clearly in this case, it was not being done. All right, and you have the expanded version. What's it called? The Philip, the Amplified Bible version. Here's the Amplified version. The leaders recognize that the old ways, and the old ways, by the way, and this is where it gets tricky, the old ways could have been inherited by, and this is what I ran into when I became that pastor of that church in 1981. What I ran into is, I was a kid, just a kid, right? And my first Sunday, they came and they said, all right, pastor, here's what you need to know. You know what we do on the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving? I said, no, I have no idea. We have a service called Pie and Praise. I said, okay. And we're going to keep doing that. We don't care what you say. We're going to have, it's a long tradition in this church. We're going to have Pie and Praise on the Wednesday night. I said, listen, obviously I'm in favor of pie. And I'm certainly in favor of praise. So I have no problem with pie. Why are you so defensive? Because we just thought you're the new pastor. You're going to probably come in here and start changing things and take away our pie and praise. I have no interest in taking away something that's good that can be used for God's glory, inherited or expected because you are part of a denomination or a group or you are expected to do something so that you do it. When we moved to that church, Katie was not yet born. 2 years old, sorry. She has an older brother and an older sister. We were expected to put our children into the Christian school that my predecessor had been one of the founders of. Terrible grammar. Six pastors got together and they started a Christian school for the area. And because my predecessor was a part of that original board and now I'm the pastor of the church, I'm expected to put my... I didn't want to put my kids in that school. We had a different plan for our kids. But man, there was pressure about that. The old ways are sometimes imposed upon you. Whatever those old ways are, however they got to be old ways, they're not producing. And here's my nod to Piper, right? God, glory, focused, grace-filled, humble, ministry-minded, well-trained, and winsome. I ran out of hyphens. Don't you love Piper's hyphens? Disciples of Jesus Christ. It's not doing that. That's not what's coming out the other end of the pipeline. Now, here's an important question that's in your notes. Are the old ways always bad ways? No, no. Not everything has to be changed. The fact that you do something does not make it sinful. It may just not be pointing us toward disciple making. There are some things like pie and praise, perfectly fine. The praise part especially, which is actually in the Bible. The pie part, not so much. But is it a bad thing? No, it's not a bad thing. Can we keep that tradition? Sure, no harm, no foul. We'll keep the tradition, okay? But there are some things that really are done only because it is traditional in this church or in churches like ours. It takes an enormous amount of courage to face that. So here's what you have to ask. What are some examples then of this church's culture-bound areas of ministries and activities? Some years later, God appointed us to plant a church. And this is not what I do best, but we started the church. Before we started the church, this is the process we went through. We went through the process of asking this question: what happens in our church, our old church, or in most American churches? What do we do that's bound by culture? Now, please be clear about this. The fact that it's cultural doesn't make it sin or wrong, okay? For example, see that offering plate? I have this up there on purpose when I'm talking, when I'm doing this lecture in other nations, I say, do you know, you'll laugh at this, do you know what happens in a lot of American churches? Do you know how they collect money to support the ministry? Do you know how they do it? They have guys specially designated with bowls. And these guys come and somebody prays, and then they pass these bowls up and down the rows, and people just laugh. Stupid Americans. What? Come on. You don't really. I said, really? Sometimes they're silver or gold. They have a special name and everything, these bowls. And they think that's the funniest thing they ever heard, because that's not. Now, here's what we know. Giving to God is biblical, right? How you collect the offering is optional. It's cultural, right? So you have to start asking questions like, why do we take an offering? And why do we take the offering in the way that we take the offering? Now, you can split a church if you say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to designate some wooden boxes. We're going to hang them on the wall in the back in several locations. And you can just worship God whenever you'd like on the way in or on the way out or sometime during the service. Just walk over there and put your gifts into the box. Ah, we've never done that. That's weird, right? The Bible doesn't regulate that. So, number two, the leaders then study the scriptures to identify the values and structural changes necessary to produce disciples. The leaders need to immerse them. What does the Bible say? Where is that in the Bible? We have to keep asking, where does that concept originate in the Bible? Why are we doing what we... Think about this. Do you have an order of service in your church? Say yes or no. Why do you have the order of service you have? Pastor decided on it. And the pastor decided on it basically usually on the basis of his experience in other churches in which he was and the norm in the American culture that surrounds that church, right? It's not wrong to have an order of worship. It's maybe helpful in some places. It amounts to being a liturgy for a lot of places. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. What if you changed it? Here's what we did in the church that I started. We decided we're going to have an opening chorus or song, and we're going to preach first. So we started at 9:30. By 9:35, I was preaching. Message first, and then the worship flows right out of what we have learned from the scripture. It was just backwards of what most church, but it was really refreshing and really helpful. And people commented how much they love that. So now, how do you do that? You need to study church history, because guess what? You're not the first ones who've ever talked about this. Isn't that true? You have to teach, because you can only change as fast as you can teach. And you have to inform the church consistently about the things that are being discussed in the leadership team and the reasons that we're thinking about moving in a new direction. Number three, the leaders then need to teach and talk about the new cultural perspective. The new cultural perspective is this is going to be an intentional disciple-making church. All that we do is going to be pointed at fulfilling the words of our Lord. Jesus said, make disciples. That's what we're going to do. So we're going to be a church that's intentional about making disciples. I need someone. Phil, can you get out from where you are just quick and come up here? This is, I probably don't have time for this, but in the meantime, I'll just give you the number four here. The leaders then enact the necessary organizational and structural changes. Can you just pop up here? Here's what we're going to do. Watch this. So I want you to stand perpendicular like that. Okay. So here's what I would say to our folks. I'm the pastor and you're a member of my church and God bless you, I love you, and I want to help you. You got your shirt on again. I love that. So here's two ways we can do that. One way we can do that is I can say, Phil, you need to grow. Get growing, man. Get growing. Come on back. That's one way we can do it. It's harsh. It's cruel. It doesn't walk with you through the process, and it's not loving. Here's another way we can do it. And I would say to folks in our church, this church probably isn't for everybody because there is an expectation of personal spiritual growth in here. If you thought that you could just come and sit once a week for an hour, hour and a half, and then leave, and the next Sunday come back, and nothing changes in your life, you were wrong. This is not the church for you. Probably have to go find someplace else. Because what we're going to do, now give me a little resistance, okay? So, because what we're going to do is we're going to walk with you, and we're going to help you, and you're going to make progress, but you're going to make, that was perfect, Phil, perfect. Thank you so much. Give him a hand, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to make progress in your personal spiritual life, and you may be dragged kicking and screaming into spiritual maturity, but we're going to support you and encourage you and pray for you and help you all the way along the way. Finally, number five, the leaders then graciously and biblically respond to the expected reaction from those vested in the old ways. And there will be a reaction. If you're going to do that, I'm leaving the church. That's the trump card that everybody can play, right? That's the worst thing they can say to you. Because I refuse. I'm not going to be a part of this disciple-making thing. I don't want to grow and change. I like just coming here and sitting and doing nothing. And if you're going to start forcing me to make progress, I'm leaving. Because there's, by the way, there's lots of churches where you can just go and sit, right? Don't be one of those. So here's the conclusion. Biblical counseling is not something more for the church. This is Bill Goode, by the way. Not something more for the church to do. It's a part of the thing the church should already be doing, which is making disciples. Now, it's time for us to be done. If you have a question or two, I know you're anxious for lunch. It's only 11:45. Come on, you had breakfast a short time ago. One or two questions, quick. Anything at all? Yes, sir.
How do you do this with a small church where some of those regular membership is twice a month?
Yep, teach. You've got to take them to the scripture to talk about why those kinds of changes are necessary. That's really good. Yep. Yes, sir. Yep. Come see me after. God bless you. We're dismissed.